The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
One hen.
Two ducks.
Three squawking geese.
Four limerick oysters.
Five corpulent porpoises.
Six pairs of Don Alvarezzo's tweezers.
7,000 Macedonians in full battle array.
Eight brass monkeys from the ancient sacred crypts of Egypt.
Nine apathetic, sympathetic, diabetic old men on roller skates with a marked propensity towards procrastination and sloth.
10 lyrical, spherical, diabolical denizens of the deep who horsed all around the corner of the quo and the key of the... bollocks quivery all at the same time.
Ah, this meeting brings back memories. Childhood days, lemonade, romance. My life was wrapped around a circus. Her name was Lydia. I met her at the World's Fair in 1900, marked down from 1940. Ah, Lydia. She was the most glorious creature under the sun. Thais! Dubarry! Gabo! Rolled into one. Oh,
Lydia, oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh, Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus, too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia. When a robe is unfurled, she will show you the world if you step up and tell her where. For a dime, you can see Kankakee or Paris or Washington crossing the Delaware. Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. When our muscles start relaxing, up the hill comes Andrew Jackson. Lydia, oh, Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the queen of them all. For 2 bits she will do a mazurka in jazz with a view of Niagara that nobody has. And on a clear day you can see Alcatraz. You can learn a lot from Lydia. Come along and see Buffalo Bill with his lasso. Just a little classic by Mendel Picasso. Here is Captain Spaulding exploring the Amazon. Here's Godiva, but with her pajamas on. Here is Grover Whalen unveiling the Trilon. Over on the West Coast, we have Treasure Island. Here's Nijinsky doing the rumba. Here's her social security number. Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the champ of the world. She once swept an admiral clear off his feet. The ships on her hips made his heart skip a beat. And now the old boy's in command of the fleet, for he went and married Lydia. I said Lydia.
He said Lydia.
I said Lydia.
We said Lydia. La, la.
I'm going to go to the doctor. I'm going to go to the doctor. Just hello, $5. Be there if you know it's good for you.
Bookman Jack on the Hallelujah Trail.
And where else would he be?
Huh? Oh boy, rough and tumble there. And the sticky knobs. And the... what are they? Lazy mice. Lazy mouse. Time for another monkey-piloted trip to the moon right here. The 20th season in the new millennium. Make no mistake about it, I'm the Bard of Broadcasting, and this is a program, the show, not a program, that made internet broadcasting what it is today. And what is it? Jonathan Geffner is back. It's been a while. We'll talk about Trillo and Suede, Van Trillo and Sam Suede, right here with me. My name is Frank Atolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show. This is it. In the deep winter of 2020. Ice cap to ice cap, from Hamlet to city, from Othello and into every bordello. I don't know what goes on with temperatures and digital equipment. No one ever taught me anything. It's not like, when you had tape, well, you don't know, a lot of you don't know, you're too young to know. When you had tape to record things, it was necessary it was tougher to do if it really got humid, and then you'd have problems in certain temperatures. And I don't know if that has anything to do. Nobody ever said, listen, if you're going to do that show, make sure there's air conditioning. And, you know, when it's really, really hot, it didn't happen. We've done shows down here. You know, it's been like 101, 102 over the years, and hasn't done anything to the equipment, or has it? That's what I mean. So I get a brand new, wonderful, from, my home hub. I don't know what to call them. The great SRN network, radio network, SRN media, supplies me with a brand new, the Logitech stuff. Is it Logitech or Logic? I think it's Logic, because I mean Logic Technical, right? So they always want to put in the intellectual angle there. And this is a wonderful mouse, because they're making them just different, smaller, you know, more compact, and they do all sorts of things with them. And they still use batteries though. And then once in a while, what is it? Is it the cold? Because it's cold in here. You know, we got cold. We got lots of different atmospheres going on here in this studio. But I don't think so. Nobody ever said anything about temperature to me. When it came to digital equipment, I don't know why. Maybe that's because it has nothing to do with it. Of course, a lot of other things they told me didn't work either, and zeros and ones are as finicky as they come. And I didn't mean that to rhyme. My name is Frank Atolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show. And, you know, in a couple of minutes, if not a couple more, Jonathan Geffner was here a while ago. You have to go into the archives. I'd have to go into the archives. I don't even think JuiceTalk.com goes that far back. But I lose count of when anything happened. When you go this long, and a lot of people, a lot of big people, you know, I gotta say this. I tweeted Time Magazine, because I have the Time Magazine feed. And I guess this still bothers me, although I don't lose sleep over it, but, you know, they have this special story that they're tweeting about and promoting about the 50 best or 20 best, or what does it matter what number, podcasts, okay, of 2019. Now, first of all, we're the only ones here who have been lobbying to change it. There's the podcasts. It's ridiculous to call them podcasts anymore because nobody listens on an iPad. Or, I mean, they do listen on iPads. I'm sorry. iPod is what it was, right? It was an iPod. Nobody has iPods anymore. You got phones, apps. I mean, that's antiquated. And the ones that were initially podcasts, nobody wanted anything to do with anyway. No less Time Magazine and, you know, National Pedantic Radio. It became pedantic. Pedantic Radio and any other number of commercial broadcasting outfits. And now everything is getting, now it's a podcast. And it's being called podcast. So Time, you know, I answered it and said, you know, why don't you ever mention, at least to give a mention to the original Internet Talk No Less Live broadcast. Or, as we like to call it, it's an e-cast. If everything is e, right, email, e, well, there's a lot of e's, I's and e's. So the other vowels we don't care about. This is an e-cast, and as a broadcast, there's no podcast, there's no pod at all. This is how the language gets screwed up, and it bothers me. But it also bothers me, I gotta say, doing this after hundreds of years, and which is what it seems like, and any innumerable changes in the whole technology, that along comes Time Magazine, you gotta say something, I gotta say something. So I say it, I get it off my chest. It's not like I expect everybody to suddenly go around and go, hey, remember him? I guess this is how the pioneers felt in the old days. In any country, every country had pioneers. Okay, in any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, this is the original Internet broadcast and talk show and live. We're still live. And of course, you can hear us again, these episodes, at juicedtalk.com. Great partners of ours. We promote them and they promote us. Lots of good stuff going on there. And what else? Well, I got to tell you, what else was I going to say? Oh, let's just, you know, we're going to go right into the fact that Jonathan Geffner is going to be here. And as I said, Jonathan Geffner, a multi-talented person. Anyway, what do you say, right? A multi-talented person, right? What do you say? He's not a multi-talented, skateboarder. And we did, there was a book. It was a Trillo and Suede book and a Trillo and Suede, stuff, but he's a great ventriloquist. I admire ventriloquism. Ventriloquism. It suddenly sounds wrong when I say it slow. Ventriloquist. Yeah, it is quit. It's a Q. It's got to be a Q. It's got to be a U, right? Every word that has a Q has a U in it. Follows it. I don't know where that rule came from, but I guess the poor Q got it. But Jonathan has got a series now on YouTube, just like, as I told you, many people are doing a YouTube series now. We had Charles Dennis on with his. With Fred Malamar and his son, and Mary Parr, of course. She comes and goes as she wishes, the free spirit, and we'll get her on here again soon. And Mary Parr, I guess, leading the parade of new YouTubers. Is that what they are, YouTubers? Now, if you were to put the YouTube shows, oh, you said, but YouTube shows have visuals too. It's like a TV thing. We're not. This was never able to really turn over. I forgot the name of that various, no, it wasn't various, it was pretty specific. That one place where you could do a radio show and they could see you. Which to me is absurd. And you know that Fat Lombard does that. You know, you could always see him. He's not that fat anymore, is he? I don't know, I don't care. I don't care at all because, bless him. He gets billions of dollars for saying nothing. That's fine. I don't say anything. Look, here's the deal. We got lots of guests coming up here in 2020. Y2K plus 20 is going to be great. Jonathan Geffner is just one who is coming here. We've already had two. Now, oh, there is one we didn't have because we did have a problem last week because of my foot. Yeah, it's like they say, yeah, you had a problem. But no, they used to say, what was the phrase? Oh, yeah, you had a problem, my foot. I don't know why the foot became the object of that particular slur. It was a slur to say it. Like, and my foot means, yeah, like you're lying. My foot turned into lies. I don't get it, but, and maybe you never heard that because you're from a part of the world where they didn't say it. But the, and here I am always joking about pain spray. And the funny thing was, boy, could I have used some pain spray, you know? And I don't want to get into the particular malady. I just want to say that between the weather and the devil on the deep blue sea, that's why we went up to the cloud last week. That would be was that the first time we went to the cloud? Yes, it is, because we have a lot of guests lined up. And the first one, who we always have, the second week in January, Jiggy Jaguar, had to abdicate. He had to abdicate because we weren't on. But I promise, because I know you're all on the edge of your seats or whatever you sit on, the edge of whatever you sit on, wanting to hear Jiggy and I completely demolish what's left of landline radio. What do they call it? Brick and mortar radio. Like, anyway, he just goes along for the ride and he tells me all the things that are happening. He tells you too, because you're listening. He tells us all the things that are happening about the radio. Like there's a lot, you know, and I sit there and go, that's crap. Because that, you know, not like this isn't, but you know, what's going on out there? And this isn't. Although we are on, we've been on a couple of AM stations because what they, you know, but it was desperation, I'm sure. Or they picked up something about me and my past that they thought would get audiences. And they don't report to me. For all I know, there's some regular AM or FM radios running this show and they're selling time on it and they're staying alive because, you know, although I can't do personal testimonies for the products that they sell on, but they're making money and they're not giving any to me. But you know what? In the long run, so what? Okay? Because that's just more people who can listen to me, and that's fine, because that's why you do a radio show. Although, you know, you're always talking to one person anyway. But let's go back to Trillo and Suede. Sam Suede is the dummy. And Van Trillo is Jonathan. Jonathan writes, we're going to find out a lot about this. These episodes. Season one is in its third episode. Just went on YouTube, and you can get it, and you should subscribe. Just like I told you when we did Mary Parr. You subscribe, it's easy because, you know, YouTube is now owned by Google, and Google, you sign in with Google. There's so many things you can. The blogger turned out, remember, our CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com, that's Google. So when you sign into, just say you sign into your Gmail, because you must have a Gmail, right? You sign into your Gmail, and you can go directly and be signed in to the Google-owned websites now, which include YouTube and Blogger. There's plenty more. And sometimes when you go to a website and you want to get into it or something, it says you could sign in with your Google. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're going, sure. They'll get all my information. Well, you know, it's time to let loose on that one. It's time to settle down about that stuff, okay? Just like in the beginning, from the very beginning, we told you there was too much concern about that. I'm not putting down the people who are precautionary because of the dark web. There is a dark web, and it ain't getting any lighter. And we've done that too. And I know for a fact that some dark web people, knocking into my return. This is called the return, which is amazing. Because you put it in to the desk and you take it out. Okay. But when I do that, could do drum breaks with my fingertips. Okay, look, the dark web. Just relax about the they get too much information. They only get what you want to give them. You know, a lot of the same people who complain about giving out information, you know, get detailed on places like Facebook. I've been on Facebook way too long to even want to spend a lot of time there anymore. So I don't. And I'm tired of kicking off the sponsors that just show up for no reason. Lots of things for that. You can block them. That's good though. That's a good thing. Just like on Twitter. And I have found that, the blocking thing, Twitter, well, that's a whole nother show. We're going to do a Twitter show one of these days. And by the way, you're welcome for the wonderful radio. This is wonderful radio. If we have to call it anything else except Cthulhu Chronicles and all the stations and ships at sea who play it through the week, you will hear this show whenever you want too, because at Juice Talk, you can do two things. When you go to the Cthulhu Chronicles section, and then you could stream it right there, or you could download it. I don't ask for money. They don't ask for money. You want to send money, do it. But, you know, maybe I should get on Periscope. You know what I should do? I'm thinking about this just now. And you know me, if you listen to this show, when I come up with ideas, lots of times they're right here, right. Well, when you come up with an idea, you come up with it, right? And I got to write it down. How about we do like a telethon? I wonder if, you know, you got to, you know, Twitter's become this incredible show place for certain kinds of entertainment, and they're private and stuff, and people are always asking for money. You know, when they go on to Periscope, they say things like, "Here's," you know, they put a little blurb about you know what they do, and of course, 9 out of 10 of them, I guess 9.5 out of 10 of them, are girls of all sorts of denominations. Saying, you know, hey, we'll go to a group. They got a group, go to private, and you got to pay them. You know, and they have Cash Apps, Venom, and I don't know Venom. I don't know if it's Venom or but there are so many avenues of paying people now digitally. So you could do that. Maybe I should go on. I'm writing it down right here. The Chronicles CC Telethon. And what would that be? Well, you know, I don't know. I can't. Put a price on, you know, what, you know, 20 years of interweb broadcasting. I don't like saying that anymore. It's getting so, you know, but, hear it? Can you hear that? That's the old furnace, same furnace we've had all these years. And I would do the telethon and say, you know, for those people who, I'd send out all the people who listen or whatever would know who they are. They know, you should know who you are otherwise. And then they'll send in money and it will help us as nothing ever helped. And all this stuff has come out of my pocket except for the generosity of, some pieces of equipment, as I said, from SRN, MediaWorks, and, back to the old days, from, Ampcast and the Waskowitz brothers. All of the things that people have contributed to keep this show on the air, okay, has not had anything to do with the public. We had a sponsor once for a couple of months, Shortstop Jeans, and then that, you know, went out of business because everything's going out of business. Not everything, but you know what I'm saying. So maybe I have a telethon and then maybe I'll get some people to get on the, we could get, you know, make, I'll bet you we could raise, if we're on for like 2 hours, 3 hours, I bet you we could raise $25. you know, there are electric bills. This is all this stuff that, you know, I just told you about batteries and then equipment breaks down. These things cost money. And things like, you know, like these YouTube shows, especially when you go watch the Trillo and Suede and you see all the things and we're going to talk about here too when we talk about the program. With Jonathan Geffner. And you're gonna know, man, these things, people are taking money out of their own pockets. This has always been the case when it comes to the internet. Okay? Cause people have been buying websites before there were, any kind of sound, whether there were MP3s or anything. And And then when there were MP3s and people were doing music, they were buying their own equipment. I mean, there were no sponsors. Okay. So when Time Magazine, tells us about the podcast that they love, you know, Time Magazine hanging by a thread too, as all magazines are. So they are just, you know, I guess they, does Time Magazine have a podcast? Everybody's got a podcast now. All the regular media people and channels have podcasts. You know, it's not enough. It's not enough for them to have a show on a television, on a cable network, or doesn't matter. They're reaching millions as it is, if not hundreds of thousands. Okay? Not enough. They got to get a podcast and then do the extra stuff. I don't know if they're paying them any more for that or what have you, but many people like me, and I don't mean they like me, many people who have done this type of thing on the internet for years and years and years, like the Artist D, Joel McCallick, Phil Hong, you know, the people at SRN, the people who have done this stuff, I know I left some out, Jiggy Jaguar, you know, most of us have done it because something about broadcasting brings us to the mic, and we've had, you know, it's been tougher times than you think now. So what happens? We mature, and then the networks and the mainstream media, they just flow in and do podcasts. Okay? So, you know, what are you going to do? This is progress. This is what happens. And it's always happened this way. The pioneers... Get a coonskin cap. I have a coonskin cap. A Davy Crockett coonskin cap, because I was a kid, and when I was 7 or 8, and you know, Davy Crockett was on Walt Disney, and I was into Davy Crockett. And I was good about that stuff, because it always led me to history, and I learned things. So there was, that was good. But, pioneers. But I gotta say that through, 20 years of internet broadcasting, I have not learned anything particularly exciting about this medium. If it's a medium, what is it anyway? I just know that there's a whole big world out there now with, and everybody is connected. Everybody wasn't always connected, but that's, you know, that's okay. We wanted more people and a larger audience. And when podcasts themselves came out, we got a larger audience. Everybody got a larger audience, even though they didn't go live, because a lot of them didn't have anything to do with broadcasting, and they did podcasts. And they were technicians, and they still are technicians. And that harangue is getting old. But I guess, as I said, when I started the whole harangue, I guess, I don't know if the opportunities to of exposure equal the benefits of exposure. I don't know. And who will know? I don't know. I know I did this and I am still doing it until I don't do it anymore. So there you go. But YouTube is now another channel. It's like another, you know, it's like there was TV, there's movies and there was TV, radio and movies. I guess radio before there were movies. Radio, movies, TV, and then what? Videotape, and then, oh, come on, what's with this? You know? Bothers me. Get bothered. No, it's not because I'm cranky. We're going to go call the one and only Jonathan Geffner and talk to him about Trillo and Suede. Then we're going to go for as long as we go. My name is Frank Catolo. Man whose name adorns it. Oh, there goes the return again. Man whose name... you know, towards the title of the show. But push the return in here. Try to get a little bit organized so we can have a good talk. Stay with us. I'm about to call. I'm about to call Mr. Jonathan Geffner. I believe he's in the... He's in the city. The city. When you say the city, what's that? The city. You know? There's that Skype sound. Mr. Geffner.
Yes, Mr. Catolo.
And how are you?
Good, how are you?
Are we coming in loud and clear?
Yes, on my end, I can hear you crystal clear. How about me?
Really, really well. And Is this a new computer or something? Or you said you hadn't gone into, cause Skype has changed so much.
Yeah, apparently. No, computer is maybe 2 or 3 years old, but I haven't used Skype for a long time. I just haven't Skyped with anybody. Sometimes I do occasionally do video chats but I usually use FaceTime. So Skype, I'm just trying it again now and I'm glad it's working.
FaceTime is what, when you go, what is, what, I don't even listen to me. Is that on Facebook or on Periscope?
FaceTime, I get confused myself. That's the one, I think it's only Apple. No, it's not just, I FaceTime with people who don't have Apple devices too. I think it's, isn't the one that's Apple based, but then you can do it if you get the app, I guess you don't need to have an Apple device. I think that's how it works.
I know people are always saying on Periscope, FaceTime, and I'm going, okay, I thought maybe that was a video thing on Facebook, because Facebook has,
yes, Facebook video too. You can video chat on Facebook in Messenger. Messenger is this thing, the way people can chat through Facebook. It seems like they're directing you to Messenger now. I don't even know what that's all about, but it's kind of like pushing you to get Messenger. So I message people back and forth. Even we communicated through Messenger on my end. I don't know if you were using Messenger, but that's Facebook connected. And then you can do a Facebook chat when you're on Messenger.
Huh.
Well, I've done that also, but for Skype, I think the last time I Skyped, I was having problems with it. I remember Skyping somebody we were having problems with the connection. So then I tried FaceTime worked better, so I just stuck with that.
Microsoft bought Skype, and then I went there one day, and you're right, less and less people are using. But, that's all because all of these programs, not all of them, but a lot of these programs were developed and without knowing that, you'd be carrying around a phone that could do everything.
Yeah.
So, but Microsoft bought it, and then, I don't know, they just changed all sorts of stuff. But this is a great, this is a really good connection.
Yes, sounds very good. We're not trying the video, but we don't need it. But as far as the audio, sounds really good.
Yeah, I don't, it's radio, so when people, I don't know why anybody wants to see each other. It doesn't matter here on radio. But, so YouTube though, were you watching things on, YouTube and stuff when you decided to, take, Trillo and Suede and do a series? How did you wind up? Cause, there's a lot of platforms for that too, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm not very media savvy or social media savvy or anything like that, but I do what I can and what I need to do now, try to catch up with the, or keep up with the younger generations of what they're doing here, because it's all about social media these days. So I'm an old dog learning new tricks.
Oh, yeah, well.
But YouTube, this Trillo and Suede thing, it's been 2 decades that I've been working on this project. It was over 2 decades ago that I had the first idea of creating this ventriloquist dummy detective duo and create a film noir parody with these characters. So that was my idea long ago, and I started writing scripts way back then, 1999 or so. I wrote the first one. Yeah, I think that was the first screenplay I wrote for these characters. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I wrote several others, and it's a long story. I guess it's a long podcast, but I don't want to. Go through all the details of it. It'll take much too long.
When were you on? Because I don't have a really good record of these shows and when they. I have many of them, but was it like 2, 3 years ago? 3 years ago?
I'm not sure myself. It's all a blur to me, past years of my past lifetime.
Well, we're blurring together, that's for sure, right now. This dummy, now you go out and perform and do parties and arrangements and company things, right, as a ventriloquist.
Yeah, that's my main career. It's been that way for many, many years. Most of my adult life, I've been a full-time or almost full-time ventriloquist.
Suede, did you make him especially for this one little duo, or did he come out of something you already had when
I
you
created the character for this particular venture? I actually don't perform normally in character as Trillo and Suede.
Mm-hmm.
My shows are kind of separate thing. On some special occasions, I have performed in mm-hmm. character, but normally I don't have an act built around them or even incorporated into it. It's specific to the scripts I've been doing. I've actually done quite a lot of little videos with Trillo and Suede,
mm-hmm.
but that's mostly for hire. People have hired me to do little greetings and things like that in character. So I've done that for a number of years. But you know, that's based on other people's little scripts or my own scripts based on what they asked me to do. It could be just birthday greetings or life event greetings or just funny surprise messages or whatever. So,
well, I watched the first three episodes. That you said there's 10 to season one?
Yes, season one is comprised of 10 episodes weekly.
And one of these serendipitous things happened, as probability will present now and then, and that for some reason I turned first time I turned on the television this morning or this afternoon when I was going to have breakfast. There's a Charlie McCarthy and I forgot his name.
Ed Bergen.
Yeah, Ed Bergen and McCarthy are there, and I had already seen the Trillo and Suede ones. I've seen you before do it, but I saw that, and I was watching. I'm watching Edgar Bergen, and I'm going, Jonathan, you're a remarkable ventriloquist. I could see Bergen's moving here and there. I just saw, and this was a very young one, because on TCM they dug up all those ones from the 30s and stuff. And I'm going, wow, I can't get a trace of your lips. I still don't know how anybody does that.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, well, when I'm on my game, I'm pretty darn good with that. Can't say I'm perfect. I don't know if anyone is, but yeah, I've got damn good technique generally. Edgar Bergen was really not a very good ventriloquist.
Yeah, am I right? Right?
Yeah, he was not a good ventriloquist technically, but he was marvelous with the characters that he created: Charlie McCarthy, yeah. Then Mortimer Snerd.
Right.
So he really brought them to life as characters, and he had very nice kind of repartee and, personality, engaging personality and so forth, and very lovely kind of act. So, he was really, really good in those ways, but technically, no, not very good.
And he's also part of that whole era that you really adore. I do, too. At the top of this show, in your honor, I played Groucho doing Lydia, the tattooed lady, with Harpo jumping around, so we do that little collage when we come into the show, and it's funny, I've seen that so many times, and this was the first time I looked at it and went, Chico's not in this scene. That was wild. I don't know why.
I'd have to watch it. I've seen it a few times, but it's been a long time, and he actually isn't.
I don't, it's amazing to me how many times I see things I like and miss, and I get so wrapped up in the enjoyment I don't realize certain things are going on in any particular movie I watch or what have you.
Well, it was At the Circus, that movie.
Yeah.
It's one of the high points of the movie. It was not one of their best movies. Of course, I love all the Marx Brothers movies, even the lesser ones. But that was one of the high points, and I remember Harpo was there.
Yeah, he's jumping around and everything. But anyway, that's that whole period. Well, that was a little later, but the whole period of that golden age, or like to call it black and white age, of comedy. When and so your affection for a comedy comes from. That's your foundation growing up. I mean, I did too on television, obviously, and then whatever was in the movies at the time.
Yeah, well, when I discovered the Marx Brothers, they became my favorite comedy team, and have remained so ever since, and great inspiration for me professionally and even personally. In particular, Harpo, he was really something about him clicked in particular. So they inspired me. He inspired me in comedy, in developing my ventriloquist act. Kind of ironic with Harpo, since he was silent, and I mean, I talk too much as a ventriloquist, but personality-wise and kind of style-wise and feeling-wise, character-wise, Harpo was the particular great influence on me. And you mentioned Charlie McCarthy, Edgar right. Bergen. I don't know if the, were you referring to the movie Charlie McCarthy Detective? I think that's the name of it.
Now, this was one of those. This was one of those Vitaphone, you know, shorts.
Oh, short.
Yeah.
Yeah, because actually, there was a movie where they Charlie McCarthy plays detective. That's the dummy. I'm not sure if both of Bergen is also. I don't recall it very well, but I know. I think that's actually the title of the movie, and so that's you know, akin to what I'm doing with Chulos and Suede in that one respect. It's. I think I'm doing something quite unique, frankly, because I've taken it. You know, to a different place with
yes.
the duo detectives in the film noir parody style. So that's something, I don't know if anyone's ever done something like that, but I haven't come across it.
Well, there have been some parodies of film noir, but tell me about that,
I mean,
too.
Ventriloquist. Oh, of course, there are film noir parodies, a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's a ventriloquist film noir.
Oh, parody. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. So you're into that? Were you into that, too? Do you watch that? You know that TCM film noir? They have every, Friday, Saturday night at midnight?
Oh, yeah, I've watched a lot of film noir movies. Good to that you remind me of TCM, because I haven't seen that for a long time, but I know that's one source of.
Well, this guy named Robert Mueller, he's wonderful. He tells you before the film goes on, and lots of times he's more fascinating to listen to than some of those movies, because some of them are real stinkers. But that's just opinion. The point is, he does this thing called film noir, and he talks, and he knows, or certainly does research, about every, he knows all these character actors. I mean, we know many of them because if we watched enough of those movies, but he knows all the background. He tells you why this one made this one or who was supposed to make this one. I personally find all that stuff fascinating. And now you're a producer and a director so you know the things that you know about what happens with this series. No one knows unless someone writes about it or something, right? I mean, you have a pretty big staff. I mean, the credits roll at the end.
Oh, the Kriak cast.
Tell us about that, because I would make up names if it was only me. I've done that on recordings, too, just to make it sound like there were more people. Who are all these people?
Yeah, how do you know they're not all fictitious?
I don't. That's what I mean. You know.
No, they're all real people there.
Well, you have other actors there too, so I know that you're not.
Well, this is professionally done. I wasn't intending to do this. I had pretty much given up the idea of doing anything big with my concept, because I kept running into roadblocks through the years with the several screenplays I wrote for feature films, almost getting funding a number of times, frustratingly number of times coming close to getting funding from one source or another, one producer or another.
Yeah, that's a pain.
It never quite happened. I did produce a short on my own called Oxford Park. About 10 years ago, Trill and Suede.
Yeah.
Professional thing that I did, in that regard. But, the big stuff, also TV, I had written, treatments and scripts for TV series based on Trill and Suede, all kinds of things, Irons in the Fire that almost got made but never did. But I kind of sort of, gave up thinking that I can only make my little videos, but I'm not going to put a lot of money into it. But finally, I decided, last year, not too long ago, in the last May or so, that, my bucket list, what's on the top of my bucket list? I said, to make something really, really good with Trill and Suede, really professional, one way or the other. So I decided web series. I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. So I finally just wrote it. I wrote
10 episodes very quickly, and of course there were rewrites before we actually shot, but I got inspired by my own writing to that I really want to do this. So I put up more money than I had intended to originally to ever do it, because as I wrote it, I started to get more optimistic about it, excited that, you know, I really like these.
And that's always that's always the case, but it did, yeah.
I inspired myself and I said, okay, well, I'll put in some dough into this and get it done properly with the professional, cast and crew. So that's what I did. And I have that, these 10 episodes now, ready to go. As you mentioned, there are three of them released so far weekly, starting with January 1st, New Year's Day. So now we've got the other seven to go, and that's season one. And I'm already making plans for season two. So not sure yet where all the money's going to come from, but I'm setting aside what budget I can. I'll probably do Kickstarter or Indiegogo sure. when it gets closer to help fund it. But I'm really eager to do a season two and keep this thing going.
It may be a little easier having a product already,
I'm hoping that this will catch on. I've got a lot of positive feedback so far, but of course, without an advertising budget, I'm trying other ways in social media and entering film festivals, entering the series and film festivals that accept web series as a category. So we'll see how we do with that. Get the buzz out there. Hopefully it will catch on, and it will be, as you say, easier to produce the season two.
The format crossovers are amazing these days. You know, I mean, even up to the Oscars, where because of Netflix and everything that's happened with Prestige TV, So yes, I didn't know there were YouTube. I know there are, I know there are independent film, a lot more independent film festivals than there used to be, because there's more access to theater, YouTube, or wherever. But I did not know there was, I don't know the particulars. But yeah, you should definitely go into that. And when you have a Kickstarter, fun starter kicker, let me know and we'll continually punch it up and tell people to get over there.
Happy to do that. Web series, it's a new thing. I don't know when they started accepting web series in film festivals, but a lot of them accept them now, and they judge them. But most of them, I find they want to see the first episode only, and then if they like that enough, then they invite you to submit the other episode or some of the other episodes as well.
Like I knew here from experience, that's exactly what happens with Netflix all these places. You know, the pilot, if you have a look at the first episode of almost anything that is already, that becomes a series, they usually just call the first one pilot, and that's the one they produce. And that's what they want. You know, they don't just order 10 episodes. What happened?
Yeah,
so it's a whole new thing out there. I want to know more about some of the people in it. You've got some good, side people, character actors there, especially the girl. I noticed the girl, the woman who's playing different, there's only one playing different parts, right?
No, I have,
Are there more? Is there more?
The character of Chloe Cliche figures the main femme fatale in the series.
Doesn't she play someone else in the third? Is that another woman?
Well, there's another femme fatale. Each episode has at least one femme fatale at a certain point in the episode, either as the client or as some secondary role.
But the actress, there's a different actress.
Sarah Pribis. Oh, I should find out how to pronounce her name. Pribis, I think. Pribis. She hosts a very popular interview show on some app. I'm so out of social media.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it's called. I forget. But I know that she's got quite a following on Instagram and things like that. So excuse if you're listening, Sarah, I'm sorry. I forgot. Never quite learned how to pronounce it.
It looks like Privis. Privis sounds right, Privis, right?
I think so.
Okay.
And she plays... the femme fatale in episode 3 and does a marvelous job. Actually, I'm very happy with all the actors. I think we I cast it very, very well. Kristen Guerin is Chloe Cliché, who figures as the main femme fatale, but she appears in almost every episode, so she has a recurring role. Mm-hmm. And then there are others. There's Katharina Schmidt plays the character of Helga, and she will appear in 3 of the episodes in total. We have also Monica Giordano plays a femme fatale character in episode 9, and she's also wonderful. And you know, all the actors. And we don't only have femme fatales. I have other characters. I have some older lady characters, very eccentric kind of characters, and then I have a couple of older gentlemen and younger gentlemen, and all kinds of a nice collection, I think, assortment of eccentric characters.
Did you know any of these people? Did you have a little casting call? Or, I mean, how did you work
casting
that out?
Call. Yeah, I had casting calls with backstage, and another one whose name escapes me now. There's another agency that provides for, arranges these casting calls. So it's the first time I've done something like this officially like that. So, we put out a casting call and had auditions and callbacks.
Then I bet you had a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I feel sorry for these actors. It's so difficult to,
right?
to make a living or get any kind of roles as actors because we were flooded.
That hasn't changed. If anything, I think it might even be, a larger community now than it was.
Yeah, I guess
before.
So. So it's, you know, and I wasn't offering a lot of money because I can't. So in the project, you know, everyone got paid, but, you know, not a large fee.
Hey, that alone is magnificent for some of these people because they're, you know, they do so much just to be seen. I don't know if they still have 99-seat theaters where you are. I think you're in New York, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. But out in L.A., we used to have these 99-seat theaters. That means you don't have to pay if it's 100, you know, unless it's 100 up, you got to pay royalties and people. And some great actors came out of it, and they would just do these parts but for nothing because, you know, people, agents would come by, you know.
Oh, I know. And I know that a lot of people do independent films and get the actors.
Sure.
For free, just usually – The deal is that if we ever make money on this thing, you'll get something for it, you know. But that usually doesn't happen with any of these films
right.
Anyway. So I know I could have done that, but I didn't want to because I just felt, you know, if I'm going to do it, I have to do it right as much as I can. Mm-hmm. I can't offer what, you know, a real production company
sure.
can offer.
Sure.
I have to offer them something because, you know, time and effort. And it's just and also I wanted to encourage really good people to audition, people who are really experienced. So this way I got some really wonderful, it was very hard making choices for these roles.
I would think so, yeah.
Good for me. Bad for the actors and all the competition, but good for me. I had some wonderful people to choose from.
But oddly enough, I don't know when this was, and I'm not going to bring up dates, although I mentioned names or what have you. I did some acting, and there was a you know, at New York, NYU, at NYU, the film school at NYU, the film course and stuff like that. The last thing that a film student would do would be make a movie, you know, complete movie, do the whole kit and caboodle. And I auditioned, oddly enough, to play and got the audition, played Chico in a Groucho Chico Harpo dream sequence of a movie that was in fact it's somewhere, it's on YouTube somewhere, and I was the person who was doing it, this is how long ago this was, the person who, the director who was doing that, we had auditions, of course, there were two people, every director had another director in the course help him out. And the guy, now I'm going to try to come up with these names. Oh, yeah, Martin Brest was one of the persons I auditioned for. And he's Martin Brest, comes from that whole Scorsese, came out in NYU, that whole Scorsese school. And mm-hmm. he directed, if I can only think of one movie, although I know he directed a lot of movies, but he directed Al Pacino in that movie where Pacino won an Oscar.
Oh, Oh, really?
In one, yeah.
That's big.
So there were a couple, and in the next room, and now his movie, see, the movie that Brest was doing as his final movie was a movie about a little creepy guy who blows up the Statue of Liberty. And so I auditioned, and then I watched his auditions, and the guy who got the part and who auditioned that day also was Danny. Now, come on, give me his last name. My what's going on in my head? Danny.
Danny Yellow?
No, the little guy, the guy from Taxi.
Danny DeVito.
This is how long ago this happened. So everybody, my point is that even people I didn't, you know, I did some other stuff, just little stuff here and there, acting. I wasn't in acting. I was just trying to do everything. But there again, everybody was working for nothing there. And, you know, going there, because there'd be a lot of exposure from NYU. I don't know what they do there anymore. So a lot of these people know all these stories because, you know, they've studied where everyone's gone. The fact that you paid anything is what I'm saying is terrific.
Yeah.
And they would, you know, they have to say is, I had a paid acting gig, period, you know. And that helps them get toward the union stuff and that whole mess. And some people become big.
Oh, I know. Of course, everybody's hoping for a break. And I hope for all the actors' sakes that this is a break for them, because that means it will be a break for me too if it's successful, if it's helping everybody. So
can't hurt. Hey, you're already looking at a second season.
Yes.
What about all the technical people? Now that's always been a problem. But what I tell people when I talk about the show business stuff that I know about, that they don't understand that there are people who want to do other things than act. And they work on these small productions, even back in those days, right? So there's a cameraman. A guy wants to be a cinematographer, right? So he does the free stuff, too.
Right. And well, these are all professionals, so I...
How'd you work that out?
I got someone to help produce it and to direct it. And this guy mainly found the rest of the crew. So this is a very difficult process because...
Well, what about unions? I mean, do they waive union stuff? Or these are like people out there working because the unions...
Well, these are people who had to deal with that issue themselves, were able to take this job. So I don't know how they work it out with the union, however they... get permission or whatever, or whether they're in the union or not. I think most of them were union members of the union, but it's the deal, you know. I'm independent. I'm not
sure
gonna necessarily pay union. I mean, I paid them, you know, I guess pretty good wages. I'm not sure if it was union scale or not.
You could throw that, if they can take care of it, that's good, because you had enough to do there. This is Jonathan Geffner. The series is Trillo and Suede. Jonathan is a terrific ventriloquist. I don't know many, but I know people who've done things and stuff over the years, and that's how I can tell how well you do it.
Thank you.
Other than trying it, which is impossible, I can't even imagine how you do it. Plus, and I didn't mention this too, because I told everyone when I was telling people that you were going to be on, and you'd been on before if they hadn't heard it, because this show has already gone through two generations. And I said, you know, Jonathan is a classically trained piano player, right? Mm-hmm. You are.
Yes. Yes, I am.
And now. This is also something I don't think I ever asked you this. Well, you know, in your admiration of the Marx Brothers, Harpo and Chico, of course, Chico more than Harp played. Do you ever sit down and just do you know anything like Chico knows it, like those style or
his what do you call that?
I don't know. What does that have a style? Have a name?
Well, I think he created that with the trigger finger, pointing. There's another word for people call it. It's escaping me now. But the way he poked the keys like a gun. He was great at that. Yeah, I I fooled around a bit with that, so, you know, so I could do it, but I can't do it as well as him. And
well, that's hard to believe. That is hard to believe if you're classically trained. I mean, wouldn't you be able to not mock it, but I mean, imitate it? How could you not imitate it?
If I put in the time to really practice it, I'm sure I could do it well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, technically, it's not that it's really that hard to do technically, but it's not that easy either to do it well. I mean,
yeah.
Never had the incentive to really, really practice that to get it good because he was great at it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they were all better musicians than they even showed on in the movies. But you, what about the music in Trillo and Sway? Tell us about that. Who'd you get? You didn't do any of the music? Or how'd you get around that?
Benya Barshai is the name of the composer. And he's introduced to me by a mutual friend. I was asking around. I have a friend named Vered Rodriguez, who's a filmmaker, independent filmmaker and illustrator. And she's a graphic artist, I guess. And she put me in touch with Benya. And I'm very happy with the music he's written for this. So, you know, he's a composer. He's a terrific guitarist also, mm-hmm. jazz guitarist. And
so he's a professional. This is how he makes his living, and he likes to score things?
Yeah.
Okay. He's a professional musician who likes to score.
Right. So, you know, I asked him if he could write something appropriate to this in the kind of film noir style and sent him links to video clips of the kind of music I'm looking for. And, you know, he wrote music in that style, which works very well, I think.
Yeah, it does, because, you know, great film and great film music doesn't get in the way. It, you know, it adds to those scenes, and so when it doesn't stick out. So yeah, it was definitely the mood of it. The other thing I really like about it, which I caught very early, and I'm sure, you know, film people and theater people would know this, but I was kind of surprised because I didn't know you would do this, but you've done it a couple of times, and that is how you break the fourth wall in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a reason for that, and obviously this is it's comedy.
Yeah.
What did you want? What were you doing with the reality there?
As I was writing the scripts, that's something that, occurred to me, as I was already into the scripts, probably the second draft. I don't even think the first draft I had those fourth wall breakings, but I was, you know, as I was looking over the first drafts, I was thinking, well, what's missing? What can I do better? Of course, no one shoots the first draft of anything. So I was thinking, well, okay, now I've got to, you know, improve everything. Well, what can make it better? And that's one of the things that occurred to me is that, like, it came from this. I was thinking the main criticism I had of my own first drafts was it's not absurd enough. I want it to be more of an absurdist kind of humor. So I was thinking of, What things can I change or add to make this more of a crazy, absurdist kind of experience? And that's one of the things that occurred. Well, you know, let's break the fourth wall. So let's do that judiciously. You know, I didn't want to do it like constantly, but I wanted to do it at some point in every episode. So that's what I did.
Yeah, it works well. And he does it too. I'm talking about your alter ego there. And you film students and people who might be listening and don't know a lot about it, but you should know about breaking the fourth wall, and that is leaving the reality and talking to of the play or the script itself and talking to the audience as if you are doing it in front of an audience opposed to so that's called breaking the fourth wall. And you guys did it, and I mean it was so fresh when you know I saw it and I went whoa, and I. You know, once it's done, I knew it was going to come in other ways too. And then when you talk to the characters, you're also breaking it. You know, it's like, that's not the script. You got the wrong script. You know, that type of stuff was really good because it wasn't just looking into the audience and, saying.
So what I tied it into, the reality of shooting on a very tight budget, very small budget. And it was, everything was going, way over budget, even, you know, even on a small budget, but mm-hmm. things were lots of things were going wrong. It was a very stressful kind of experience in that regard. So I put that into the scripts. I even added some last minute changes to the scripts to reflect that reality, because I figured, you know, rather than sort of cover for it or try to pretend this is an HBO level budget production or something like right. that. Well, obviously it's not. I wanted to make it as good as I can production value wise, but of course I'm limited. So, why not even utilize that in the scripts and refer to most of the fourth wall breaking has to do with things going wrong on set, supposedly, because we don't have a budget to do things properly. So I, utilize that experience.
And oddly enough, it's fresh, because I think that's what got me, because, I obviously know that and, I've seen it done and everything, but, you don't see a lot of that, and the new filmmakers don't do it even as an absurd gimmick.
And another thing that the way I decided to do this was that whenever I decided whenever I break the fourth wall, I want the characters to remain the characters, but through the wall. Mm-hmm. So in other words, like when the character Chloe Cliché barges in at the wrong time in episode 3 because she misread the script, got the script mixed mm-hmm. and stuff. But the character, the Trillo character, addresses her as Chloe as they have an argument, and Chloe addresses them as Trillo and Suede. And so it's, I thought it adds another level of absurdity. It's like we're breaking the fourth wall, but we're still staying in characters. So
right.
It like makes you wonder, well, are they real characters or are they supposed to be real characters? So I wanted that confusion to remain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it works like that too, because he's, I'm trying to think of other things beside Bergen and his group. There weren't a lot of others who were in movie characters. I know Paul Winslow and Jerry Mahoney did some dumb little, but they had television, but, they did some movie stuff, character stuff. There's not a lot of that either, happening around. So you have a double absurd layer there because, he's a dummy.
Right, exactly.
And he's constantly trying to be more human than you. You're putting you down to equalize his own being, presence.
Right.
And, that works a lot. And also the other thing that's good about it, and I hope you people are writing down these notes here so that you can watch for these things, whether you make films or not.
They'll be test later, everybody.
Yeah. There'll be a quiz. Is the ethnic stuff. I love the ethnic stuff and how you work it, what was that one? Bringing a gavilta. What was that? Bring on a gavilta fish. What was that one line? The Jewish stuff.
There's a lot of Jewish stuff. It's very Jewish web series. So I'm drawing on my own knowledge.
Right, right.
Growing up, and I'm fluent in Yiddish. I teach and I translate Yiddish.
I'm
fairly fluent in Hebrew as well. And I'm a secular Yiddish scholar, a non-religious Yiddish scholar. So I'm real odd in those ways. I seem to always choose everything in life that is very eccentric and unusual and different. So I'm, because the Yiddish is not spoken much. It's pretty much died out except for enclaves of Hasidic neighborhoods. A lot of them, the Hasidim, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, in other words, for those who don't know what that is, they still speak Yiddish, but most of the non-religious Jews, very few of them speak Yiddish, but I do. I actually studied intensively and got a degree in it and went on to teach and so forth. So anyway,
does not surprise me. My audience should know because a couple of years ago I went back to Brooklyn where I grew up, and that neighborhood within like two or three blocks of the neighborhood has become like, little Tel Aviv. I'm Hasidic. I don't know if you could. Hasidic and Tel Aviv don't really match, though, do they?
Not exactly.
But it was amazing to me. I thought I was, it's amazing how these cultures of, you know, they become tribes. They always, you know, more so now than they did when I was growing up. Although there were, you know, there's a German neighborhood, the Jewish neighborhood. But getting the ethnic thing in there, I think is really good, especially since I, you know, I was making notes while I was, not to forget stuff I saw in the episodes. But, you know, Suede does not look Jewish at all. I don't know how you'd make one of those dummies. Well, you know, he looks rather, you know, full-blown Caucasian. You know, he doesn't look, Jewish in the theater kind of way. Not that there's someone looks Jewish, you know, you don't get into that stuff.
Well, you mean that. Typically or stereotypically Jewish.
Yeah, stereotypically. Yeah, he just looks like, you know, that little white guy. And that's good, too, because it, you know, it draws a conflict between the two of you, which, you know, makes for story and drama and humor.
Yeah.
And you got something to draw on because you're a scholar.
Yeah. Well, my experience growing up, I am drawing from a lot of things. So I figured that's what comes naturally to me.
Sure.
So it's at first I was hesitant about that. My first drafts had very little Jewish stuff in it, because I was thinking, you know, I want to reach a mass market, and that's very, very specific. A lot of people are not going to be familiar or interested in that. But then I decided, you know, that's one of the things also that I felt was missing from the first draft. It's not really strong point of view of something of like a feeling, a character, is that a character of the show. I wanted to have more of a, like an imprint of, you know, what it's about. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that would help, I felt, is, well, right from my strength.
Yes.
My strength is my own background.
Sure.
In Jewish stuff. So let's do it. Whatever occurs to me that I think is funny in a Jewish way, just don't be afraid to put it in. So it wound up being, I wasn't planning on making it any particular amount of Jewishness, but as I was writing and thinking of things that I think would be funny, well, a lot of it turned out to be Jewish oriented. So
yeah,
I figured I'll go with it.
It also gives depth and puts us, you know, some more skin onto a character when you know a little bit more about it ethnically. So, mm-hmm. You know, otherwise they're all, because, you know, I would imagine, you know, this better than anyone. And that is, you're dealing and working with an inanimate character. you got this duality going while you're doing him, and you have to immediately switch, over when you're talking to him. That's a strange thing in itself, because no one actor plays two parts at the same time, right?
Yeah. Oh, that is unusual, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Because, that's why, I have the two lead roles.
Yeah.
And Suede.
Absolutely. And when, and it's not just the moving of the lips or not moving of the lips in the sense that, you create, another character, and he does. And you know that that's like, inherently, you know, whoever this thing in my hand has got to be different, and you've got to communicate with one another, and he has to communicate with whoever the other characters
mm-hmm.
are differently than you have to. And so all that when that comes together, so the ethnic stuff works good too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully it comes across as very distinct characters, because that's how I feel about them and want them to be. Trillo and Suede have their own definite personalities, and how I feel about it. I mean, when I'm operating, manipulating Suede, bringing him to life, I feel that he's a unique, separate entity. I mean, that's what happens at a certain point in ventriloquism when you're immersed in the role and creating it. I really feel like he's real. There are moments that are surreal to me that occur when I'm performing shows as well with
mm-hmm.
whatever character, where I suddenly have this kind of sort of epiphany or shock or something that it hits me that I go, oh wow, he's a puppet, isn't he? I forgot to talk. Most of the time I completely forget about that.
Right.
I really, you know, really feel that he's a real person, and then it just occurs to me every once in a while, oh, actually I am making him talk. How about that? I kind of forgot about that.
And he could surprise you too, because you're so in character that you could, you're his brain also. So your brain is working with two and coordinating it, I imagine. When they teach you ventriloquism, they don't deal much. You're saying that this kind of happens once you really get into the, to being able to manipulate both characters, the live one and the one you're making live. They don't really get into that. They get into the, right?
I mean, I'm self-taught as a ventriloquist, so it's a gradual process of,
where does one go? Where would one go? Where would one do? How do you learn it?
Nowadays, it's different from when I was young and learning it. There was no internet, pre-internet days, so it was more difficult in those days. I learned by going to ventriloquist performances every chance I could get, mostly in nightclubs, comedy clubs, things like that, and just trying to study what they're doing and going backstage and trying to meet these ventriloquists and talk to them and get tips from them. And some of them would talk to me and some of them wouldn't, but, you know, whatever tips I can get. Then there was I found out through the grapevine about a ventriloquist convention, international convention every year that was held in Kentucky, and near Cincinnati. And so I started going to that every year. That was very helpful in watching all kinds of
convention. I wonder, in the hotel rooms, do they have like separate beds? They have like twin beds?
These people. I think most of us are not that crazy, but there are some. We have trouble with that line, with drawing that line.
But you learn, what would you learn from them? I mean, like, I'm having trouble with my T's. I can't get a T out. I mean, by watching them, how do you learn? I mean, this is a physical, it's a physical talent. You've got to learn to do that without, you know, the jaw work and everything. You can't watch it, not from watching them.
Just the technical things about how to talk without moving your mouth to produce the double labial sounds, which are B, N, and P mainly, the hardest ones. And there's also F, V, W that are hard without moving your mouth. So you have to learn how to do that without moving your mouth. So that's the technical thing. But there's also other things like producing a distant voice, making your voice sound like it's coming from farther away from you. Throwing your voice, right. So that's, creating that illusion. There's certain technical aspects of it that you can sort of learn, get pointers from other people. But it's more than that. It's putting the act together. It's creating the differentiation between the characters. It's creating or choosing a puppet voice, a character voice that's good, that works. It's the animation of the puppet, moving the puppet so that it seems to be alive and real and moving smoothly. It's the personality difference. And it's the material too, how you what kind of material you do, how you do it. So there's all those elements to it.
So the rapidity, if that is actually a word, by saying how fast you do it, it's changing. I always, when ventriloquists, I always not just amazed at how they can say those words and say words and not move their voice or even a little bit move their lips. I mean, it's the quickness of, you got to change a character. You don't just play two characters. There's times when you change it really, really quick. It's so, and the ventriloquist is going, that's the way it is. What I mean? This crosstalk and everything, which really, I mean, I don't even know about. I don't know how you even practice it.
It comes gradually. It becomes more and more second nature. Of course, in the beginning, it's very, you got to really think about that a lot and keep track of it all. But it becomes second nature after a while, after many performances. I mean, I can't count how many thousands of performances I've done through the years. So it's all very second nature by now.
And you've seen really, really bad ones, haven't you?
Yes, there are very bad ones. Yeah.
What?
Do you find
yourself personally embarrassed when, even though no one knows you, you're sitting there watching someone, right? And you see them doing that?
It was more a number of years ago when I was becoming really good at it, and then I saw there was some performers who were really bad at it. I was thinking that that's bad for the profession. People thinking that ventriloquists are just, you know, bad. They don't really create that illusion at all. And so I don't. I thought that's sort of bad for the profession. But there are a number of really good ventriloquists who became famous, popular, or famous in more recent years. So, you know, that's good for the profession in that sense of, you know, people having an image of ventriloquism being good, performed well, you know, what an impact it can make when it's done well.
Well, aside from that, Joram guy, whatever his name is, Jeff
Dunham.
Yeah, but aside from him, name us, you said there's a couple more that are pretty famous. Tell us a few that we might look for, right. You know.
Well, Jeff Dunham is the most famous, I'm sure.
Sure.
And he's an excellent ventriloquist. And there's also Terry Fader. He won America's Got Talent how many years ago? 10 years ago?
Fader? What's his last name?
Terry Fader, F-A-T-O-R.
Okay.
He's excellent also. He's he's specialized in singing. He's great. They're great at singing.
Oh, my God.
The puppets sing. So that's his shtick. That's his main thing is singing in different character voice. But he's great. I mean, Dunham's great. Fader's great. Ron Lucas is a great ventriloquist.
Ron Lucas. So I'm going to write these down here. Lucas, L-U-C-A.
Yeah. And let's see. There are others.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I could
not as famous, but pretty, you know, pretty well known. Who else can I? Names are escaping me now.
It's okay. That's okay. Yeah. Once you get to them, you could probably you know what the internet is like. You get to one or two, and then somehow they linking to every Tom, Dick, and Harry with a thing. What is there anything? This is a. An ancient, I guess, by comparison to time and other things that people do or juggling or whatever, but this is pretty much an ancient talent and act, right? I mean, this goes back to where? Do you know anything about the history of who's the very
I've read that it is.
You must. You're a scholar. I shouldn't even ask, do you? Of course you do. Tell us a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm mostly a Yiddish scholar. Ask me anything about Yiddish history.
Well, I don't know. I can't compare you with the Yiddish, but I know you're great at this, so I'm going, you must know a lot about that.
I'm not a scholar in the history of ventriloquism, but I've read about it, so I know certain things. One is that it is believed by many people that ventriloquism was used in the days of Greek mythology, but I can't remember right now which story. There are stories of, what was it, the oracle? Do you know Greek mythology, the oracle?
That sounds familiar. The oracle sounds familiar.
Whoever the character is supposedly talk to the dead, or there's some story like that, or Greek myth. Right? And a lot of people theorize that it's based on an actual priest from those days that who used ventriloquism to make it sound like the dead are talking. it's just a theory. And then also in the Bible, there's also something where I can't remember the.
There's a ventriloquist in the Bible. That is I love. I write this down, everyone.
Quite possibly. Some place, I'm not a Bible expert either, biblical at all, but there's some story where there's one of the characters is also talking to the dead from in a grave or something, and the voices heard coming from the grave, and it's theorized that he might very well have been a ventriloquist, figuring out, you know, how to do it way back then.
To me, that equates to finding fire, you know, because there is nothing, right? There is no one who can not move their mouth and talk, no less throw their voice, and suddenly there is someone. That's like outrageous. You would think that it would be, and you know, no one has done that. Not even Mel Brooks has done. I haven't seen any like, you know, really wild comedies where they, you know, in history where they use a dummy. Like imagine redoing, True Grit with a dummy instead of a little girl or something.
Yeah, they got to learn how to do it, first of all. Although they can fake it. That's one of the things also, I think, maybe hindered getting Trill and Suede done as one of my big projects, is that the people could just fake the ventriloquist. Right. Say, oh, we need a ventriloquist for, we can fake it. These days, that's overdubbing, you know. So
that's
one
right.
thing. I mean, as a ventriloquist, you know, I know the difference. I could always tell the difference. But maybe, depending on how well they do it, maybe a lot of the public wouldn't be able to tell. But I still think that even if they don't know the difference, it still will look more authentic if side by side people saw a real ventriloquist and a fake ventriloquist with overdubbing. It would just feel more realistic when a real one's doing it, because there's something, well, it looks fake about it when I see someone faking that. And I have seen that in films sometimes. They fake the ventriloquist. I mean, that always bugs me about that. But this reminds me of something you mentioned before about the not moving my mouth. I'm good at not moving my lips. Actually, when I was looking at the footage, sometimes I was disappointed in myself that sometimes my lip control slipped a bit, you know, it's right. not perfect. And I was thinking, sometimes I was choosing, looking through shots and decide, well, which take am I going to tell my editor to use? Sending shot selections to my editor. And then sometimes I like this take better, except I moved my mouth a little bit there. But sometimes I would just choose that take anyway. Okay, I'll use that anyway because I like the take. And I was thinking, I mean, aside from that, like the acting or whatever. But and then I was thinking, you know, maybe it's actually good if there are a few shots that someone might be able to catch my mouth moving a little bit, my lips moving a tiny bit, because maybe then it's more convincing that it's real. Because if I'm perfect, then maybe people think, look, he never moves his mouth. It must be overdubbed.
Well, let me say two things in relationship to that. Number one is they're not looking. If you're introduced as a ventriloquist, they're not looking for your flaw right away. They're expecting what you know, for you not to move your, everybody knows what it is. And lots of times, once you get them, you got them. They're not looking anymore. Like you would come out and screw up right away, you know, you would lose them. But once you got them, they're not looking. They're not going, oh, look, we are our worst critics, right? When that happens, and people who don't know certain things, people who watch great musicians, people who watch ventriloquists, magic magicians, jugglers, or whatever it is, you know, they don't see they don't see the smallest flaws, but they also they also turn out to be very much on your side, you know, and it's like this guy is good, and once they get there, even though they know nothing about the science or the art or what the person's doing, once they get there, they're on your side.
Right. Though the characters are what is most important for sure. Mm-hmm. The strength of the characters. Once you've established that, then that remains the strong point. But still, being good at ventriloquism helps to maintain the realness of the character as a separate entity. So it certainly helps. But I agree, it's not the main thing. And that's why Edgar Bergen was able to be so successful, even though he really was not a good ventriloquist,
right.
because his characters were strong.
There also wasn't a very big ventriloquist pool, I guess, in those days, were there? I mean, making movies?
There was, because in vaudeville, there were lots of ventriloquists back then in vaudeville. Most of them were not famous. I mean, very few got famous, but just as now, most of them are never going to be famous. But yeah, there were a lot of ventriloquists working in vaudeville when there still was vaudeville in those days. But I don't know what made certain people, I mean, Edgar Bergen, I mean, not that he didn't deserve it as far as his entertainment value, but he certainly was not the best ventriloquist.
Mm. The Scatola Chronicles were with Jonathan Geffner, who is a professional, and I keep telling people, you know, don't use that word unless you know the definition. He gets paid. That's what makes you professional, okay? To get paid to be a ventriloquist. This, to me, is great because you have to. That's what you write on your tax form, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And
that's right.
You know, we did a show about a bunch of people who would and they're rare. I think it was some lyricist. It was like one of the biggest lyricists of the guy who did. Anyway, the point is he has to put down the occupation, lyricist, you know, and, you got to wonder if people look and go, oh, yeah, you know, because there just are so few of them. But it's a great thing to do that, to be able to do that. And, you know, no matter what they say, you prove it because you are, you know why.
You know what you said about putting your tax returns. Actually, my accountant, who I've used for many years, he's from the start, and every year he has told me put down puppeteer entertainer.
Puppet.
Generic. And he said, but that's too weird. And it might be a red flag. They're going to think like this. That sounds suspicious. That's too weird. We have to check this guy out. So he's just put down puppeteer. It's not as weird.
I think puppeteer is weirder than ventriloquist. Everyone knows when you think of puppeteer, you think of the strings and Punch and Judy stuff.
Puppeteer includes many different kinds, like ventriloquists are kind of puppeteer, and there's also, marionette puppeteer.
Yeah, do they know that at the IRS? Do they have a catalog of, look at the genres of puppeteers we have here, pal. Hey, pal, look at this.
I don't know. So far, maybe it's coincidence, but his advice worked so far because I have never been audited. Not yet.
Well, you never put down ventriloquist, did you?
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Maybe
he's right.
Then you don't know.
Avoiding ventriloquist has saved me from an audit.
Entertainer you get away with a lot putting down entertainer, even as an extra. And I've been able to do that. But that's only so you could take things off of your taxes. What about making Suede and your other puppets? Because now it becomes more complicated to be a ventriloquist. You've got to create your own character with voice and with attitude and everything, but you also have to make it, right? Can you go out? Are there guys out there and go, hey,
I don't build my own puppets, no. I tried that many, many years ago. I went to an intensive weekend of puppet making workshop with a master puppet maker named Verna Finley, I attempted to make a puppet, but after that weekend I decided this is not for me. I'm not good at this. That's not where my talent lies. My talent lies in bringing puppets to life, but not creating them. Leave that to other people. So it takes a different kind of skill and a lot of patience. Oh, I don't have that kind of patience.
Yeah, me neither.
If I had to, you know, necessity, mother of invention. So if I had to, I would do it because I need the puppets, but I'm glad that I don't have to. I'm glad I can find out. I just buy my puppets from other people.
So there's also people out there who put on their tax forms puppet maker?
What is it called? Especially if they put a ventriloquist puppet maker, that would really be odd or unusual, right? And you know, the proper term is ventriloquial figure maker.
Oh, I love that. That's good.
Are ventriloquial figures. That's the proper name for them. But I'd call them either puppets or dummies. And some people wonder, am I offended by calling them dummies? No, not at all, because that's a traditional word for a ventriloquist. Yeah. Puppet is a dummy, so I don't mind calling them dummies.
Well, would you go to one of these guys and say, I want something that looks like, do you give them any kind of description or just to say male or female or what?
Yeah, I've got a lot of characters through the years. I have about, I lost count, maybe 20 different characters.
Well, did you describe what you wanted?
Yeah, I got them in different ways. In some cases, I described what I wanted, and I sent pictures of something of similar kind of characters. And I said, create something like this. The nose bigger or this or that, whatever. And in some cases, I found puppets as is that people were selling.
Oh, okay.
Or someone else had, and they're selling their own puppet, used puppet. So it's I've gotten them those various ways.
As far as acting is concerned, in whatever of capacity it takes place, because obviously you have to make a character of yourself in order to have the contrast with your puppet. But as far as that's concerned, do you feel that you could drop him acting wise, or is this just part of it? Or you have to have, you do it and you do it with him or you don't do it. This team can't break up, is what I'm saying, right?
You're asking me if I'm interested in acting.
You want to go solo? You want to drop Suede and go solo?
I've never had a strong urge to be an actor. I've had some interest in it, and I still do. I enjoy acting. I've done a little of it, but it wasn't a passion of mine. Ventriloquism is a passion of mine. You know, it's specifically to act in this context is something that is what really has grabbed me. I mean, if I had the opportunity, yeah, there were certain roles that I would enjoy doing as an actor, but, you know, it's not something that is really vital to me. And Trullo and Suede, yeah, they're an inseparable team. I can't imagine Trullo without Suede and vice versa.
It sounds to me like you have a little theme there for an episode.
Marriage made in heaven.
A little episode there for him.
Yeah, look, that's good for a whole season there. That subject.
Yes, and I do have. I'm not going to say this on the air, but I will, I'm going to write you a paragraph of something that came to me while I was watching this. If you want to run with that, or if you just hate it, just say, I hate it, Frank. Go away.
Oh, okay. Well,
you know, because something came up, I just had a great idea that I think it's a great idea, but we'll do it. We don't want to tell anybody because they may steal it. How far can you go with – oh, you know what I want you to do? Do this for me. We got another 20-some-odd minutes. Just do something now. Talk like him, even though this is the radio. And we know, we trust, my audience trusts me if I don't. He is not moving, believe me, not only his lips. And you could, hopefully they're all going to, you know, go to Trullo and Suede and watch it. But say something now, or talk to me now like Suede, if I'm talking to Suede. And
Frank, this is a problem.
Is it? Is it?
It's not a problem for me. It's easy for me to do. Well, but psychologically, I feel like I'm betraying Suede because he's all packed up right now.
I love it.
And I feel like if I do his voice, it's like something just feels weird to do it without him. We're going to just ask everybody out there in podcast land to go to YouTube and check out Trullo and Suede for real.
Could you do it as if he's in the talking through the case or the box?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to. No, I don't want to push. I don't.
Not here.
I understand.
In the basement right now.
I know. But, you know, you can't. Got to ask.
If I had him out, then you know, next podcast, remind me, I'll have him out. That way I'll feel like I'm not doing him a disservice.
But that also, even though you're not doing it, that says a lot about, you know, your connection to the art.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that's, you know.
Either that or it says a lot about my mental state.
Come on. It's mental state. You can play music and read it at the same time, right?
Yeah.
See, I can't do that. I mean, I can pick up things. I heard the Circle of Life was on, and I have a piano right here because I've always played around with it, but not, you know, not the way. And, you know, I can go and find it. And never having played it and hear it and play it. But, you know, if you put Brahms in front of me, forget it. I might as well be a dummy, so to speak.
Oh. Well, there are all kinds of musicians. It's amazing the discrepancies or the unevenness in the various developments of talent. Because, there are musicians. There are great musicians who never learn how to read music. And then there are great classical musicians who can play the most glorious and complicated the pieces, but are not good at improvising, you know, little things or whatever. It's like very uneven developments. So you never know what people are good at.
Have you seen the movie Green Book?
No.
You must see Green Book for a couple of reasons. And there's a piano player and a really great piano player, except he's not playing it. You got to watch how they actually taught him to move in certain areas. And when they put in the music, it literally looks like he's doing it. I mean, there aren't just soul shots of his hands. It's a remarkable new way of doing it. I just, you know, you're seeing somebody who doesn't play piano really well and has to play piano really well in a part, you would say like, wow, how are we going to find the perfect person for both of those, right?
Are you saying the actor was a pianist or just was faking the piano playing?
He's faking it. He may know a little bit, but nowhere near what is demanded of him in this character, and it's beautiful, you know? You've got to watch it. For lots of reasons, believe me, there's a lot of reasons and a lot of reasons, but it's a great movie. It's on Prime or one of them. It's on. You should see it. It's worth the investment of time. Not just for that, for lots of reasons. But I was thinking, but I was thinking of that too, because the guy, ventriloquism, you can't, it would even be tough to fake in a little movie. Yeah. It might not, you know what I'm saying? It might not work as well as really, and it's an exact science, like you're saying. Yeah. There are a lot of different kind of musicians, but there aren't a lot of different kind of ventriloquists. So this is an exact science, isn't it?
I guess the technical, when you get down to the technique of it, yeah.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Either you can do it or you can't. But there's all different kinds of characters and personalities, you know, but that's something else. Just technically, yeah, just either know how to do it or not.
So you're going to keep doing these things. Now, you shot all around New York, right?
Right. I'm in New York. I live in New York, yeah.
No, I mean, you shot the
scene. We shot it in Brooklyn. Mostly in Brooklyn and, a little bit in Queens, but it's mostly Brooklyn.
So how did you decide to, locations?
Found me a place so I could shoot for free. A friend of his, let us shoot for free in this this office that he has in Brooklyn. So I could not turn down that opportunity because budget was a huge factor. So
do you still need to get a permit outside when you do that kind of stuff?
Oh, for the outdoor.
Yeah, how about outdoor shots? Exterior. Excuse me.
Yeah, technically, I think we need a permit, but we didn't have permits. We just shot.
Okay, fine. That's fine. I mean, ad hoc, some of the greatest things come out of ad hoc. And it didn't matter that much, right? Because some of the scenes just doesn't matter if you're talking on a park bench near the river or.
We shot wherever was available where we could grab a location that looked right, that looked good. And luckily, no cops interfered with us. But I guess that could have been a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think of things like how far? Let's say you have a gigantic budget. How would that affect how you would approach let's say doing an hour and a half or 2 hours, whether it was a series or not? Oh, by the way, listen to this, and this might help you out. I learned the other day because I have some connections with doing stuff. Anyway, Netflix budget. Next year, or would be, I guess, the season or whatever, for new content. You ready for this? You don't even take a guess on this?
For what? A budget for what?
Doing all their series and new series, you know, for getting new content. No, I'm sorry. It's, it says here new content. For new content. Okay?
Oh, well, so that's all for all their productions all put together?
Yeah.
Total budget?
Yeah.
Or development of new.
Yeah,
I have no idea. Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, how about this? Because this blew me up. Either I read this wrong. It's either 1.7 billion or 17 billion. And that was a typo. But either way, that's monstrous. And and what I'm saying is that your stuff and your guy and the whole world of Trillo and Suede is not beyond the realistic attempt to do something with it in terms of a prestige TV, as it's called. I know a lot of people. I know. I realize a lot of people who do a lot of different things in terms of film are going to Netflix for stuff. But boy, the hunger for content is outrageous.
Yeah. Well, I hope that that's going to help me in this in Trill and Suede. Of course, I'd love for Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime or
there's so many.
Whatever to notice this series and like it. And you know, I hope I'll be doing a series for one of the big guys someday. But
that's what led me up to saying, if you were do you sit back and think, wow, if I had money, this is the kind of noir thing I would do, or or do you sit back and go, geez, a costume thing? You know, I mean, what's the highest level that you can imagine if you have the money to do a Trillo and Suede, you know, film story, whatever.
Well, through the years, I've written several feature film screenplays for Trillo and Suede, and those were done, well, several of them were done without budget worries because I was encouraged by someone in England who had a small production company who told me, oh, just write the best movie you can, and I'll find the budget, I'll find producers. And so I did it several times. Well, there were four different scripts that I did that would have been required a high budget, a large budget, and no way around it. But, you know, I said, but we're not going to have the budgets. Oh, no, don't worry about it. I'll find it. So I wrote the damn scripts, and I wrote exactly like you're asking me, just whatever came into my head that I want to see on the screen. And it would require a large budget. But it turned out, no, he couldn't find the production company, so we never filmed it. But, yeah, I guess maybe the biggest one of the ones I wrote is one let's see, Once Upon a Time in Shanghai was the working title for it. So it takes place in a mythical version of Shanghai, China, and Trill and Suede are on location there, tracking down stolen jewels and whatnot. And that would have required, I don't know how much money, like that could be a Hollywood, you know, sure, blockbuster, hundreds of millions of dollars.
But where was the money? Where was the money in that? I mean, was it not just location? It was big how more.
Because, yeah. I mean, first of all, there was things like I had a couple of helicopters in it. I had gangs, like I wanted to have large numbers of gangs, mm-hmm, members of like gang fights and gangsters of various kinds. And the sets would have been pretty extensive if I could do it the way I wanted, you know, recreating an old, like 1930s Shanghai.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Stuff like that. So with all the costumes and the extras and the cars.
Action. Lots of action.
Action.
Car chases or rickshaw chases or whatever.
Yeah, that's all of that was in there. Well, not the main thing, but look, so yeah, it's not as big a budget as some of the Hollywood stuff now, come to think of it. It's, you know, but it would have needed at least a couple million dollars. Now that's a nothing budget.
Yes,
for Hollywood,
exactly.
You know?
That's nothing.
But I'm saying with unknown actors, obviously you hire one actor, an A-list actor for $10-20 million, that kills the budget. But so this would have to be unknown actors, but still just the budget of the sets and locations and equipment and crew, and all that would have been at least a couple $1 million.
And yeah, and that's what I meant. You're right. That's nothing. But, you know, once you put in all, you know, the stunts and the things and the cars and the crashes and the people, you know, you can, you know, I'm sure you could even think, more expensive than that if you really wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I meant. What would be the ultimate Trillo and Suede adventure?
I haven't thought
of that one.
Not really even interested in that, because for Trillo and Suede, that would be the Shanghai script would be sort of I think the most expensive thing that I've come up with so far that I would want to do, because there I wasn't thinking about limiting myself, because I could have had you know, more expensive, like all kinds of bombs and
but still noir. Still,
but I didn't need that. But I needed certain things to create this gangster warfare kind of thing. So that would be, as of now, that's the biggest thing that I would like to do if I could. But it's not necessary. There are other scripts that you know, that are more modest, but still would require a lot more than what I've done now. Even what I did now with this 10-part series, which they're short episodes for those of you out there who haven't checked it out yet. They're very short. They're just about 5 minutes each.
Yeah.
That's all I can afford to do this time around, 10 short episodes. But if I had more money, I would have done other things with this too. There are other things I would have, you know, the set, I would have done different things with the set or on the set,
right,
and location wise. And the scripts themselves, I was very limited to the number of cast I could have here, because you couldn't afford to pay more than that. So I would have had, I would like to do bigger stories with greater numbers of cast. If I could, but as it is, I did the best I could to try to make fun exciting, funny little episodes with a minimum of cast.
Absolutely. I didn't, you know, you certainly weren't, you know, you don't have to apologize for, you know, what you do for the money, obviously. I was just thinking, you know, what, you know, because you enjoy it so much. You went to do this, you know, and so like I would imagine you'd be, you know, you'd want to go. And, you know, you might have said, no, no, I want to keep it, like, even with a lot of money, I'd like to keep it intimate and, you know, not go crazy.
I know what you mean. And it's true. That's why I would, there is a limit to it. It's not like, oh, the more money, the better.
Right.
Because I would never need to go that high. Like I was saying, Shanghai script, you know, I think maybe $2 or $3 million, that would be doable for what I wrote. And, you know, it's good enough for me. It's not like, if someone said to me, hey, I'll give you another, $10 million and have some bomb explosion. I don't need that, you know?
So, well, there's a conflict right there though. I mean, if, you know, I would imagine, the Chinese might want to find other uses for the wood that you carry around.
So for that reason, I wouldn't shoot in China. I don't think recreating Shanghai someplace, maybe in Vancouver or something like that.
Yeah. Why did they reject? I heard Jerry Seinfeld say this on one of the, why did the Chinese reject forks? They're like, no, we're going to stick with the sticks. We're going to stick with the, you know, that's, reminds me. But anyway, just thinking.
For them, it's no loss.
So let's go through all the stuff here before we end in terms of where to go. Everybody knows where to find YouTube. If you sign in, I told everybody how to sign in. If they haven't, you got your Google, bought it. So you go in with your Google thing and subscribe because you want those numbers.
Oh, yeah. And you don't want to miss any exciting episodes. So when you go to the channel, first thing you should do is subscribe. You hit that little subscribe button and then the little notification bell, hit that one too, because then you'll be notified each time a new episode or another video too is, any Trill and Suede videos are released. And then enjoy the videos. Watch them in sequence, I recommend, because, it's an ongoing story too.
Yeah.
They can be enjoyed separately too, but, you know, you kind of, get the most out of it if you start.
They can look through it and then you watch, and then you can, when the first season is done, you could go back and binge on it, you know?
Watch
them all like it's one big movie. You could do that too. What else, sooner or later, you're going to make the, you know, the little suede toys that people.
Oh, yeah, merch is on.
Merchandising.
Hey, see how woke I am? I called it merch. And I use the word woke.
Oh.
That shows how woke I am that I said woke.
He's right into it.
As soon as we get enough following up there, then on YouTube, then we'll start selling merchandise, the Trill and Suede t-shirts and sweatshirts and mugs and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
We'll be doing that.
Well, you'll keep us up to date with everything that's happening. I'll send you a few things and, you know, emails and we'll talk or what have you. And then you can go, as the series goes on, maybe when the first season is over, we could have another talk, and, you know, see how it's all doing and where you're going to go from there.
Sure, I'll be happy to.
Yeah.
Talk about season two. I've begun writing it already. Good. Writing season two.
And then, so that's YouTube, but there's not much else to say. Trillo, if you know how to spell it, T-R-I-L-L, just the day not a spell. You could see it there. If you just put in Jonathan Geffner, would you get it? Or do you have a separate, page?
Yeah, it should come up. I didn't test that on Google, but, I don't know. If you see a Google search, put in my name, maybe it will come up, maybe not, but you put in Trillo and Suede, it will come up. Suede is like the kind of smooth leather suede. And Trillo, by the way, we were talking before about how much Jewish humor is in this series.
Yeah, but I saw that,
I noticed that Trillo is half Italian.
Yes.
I made him half Italian.
Yeah,
I don't know if you caught that in the second episode. He briefly describes that. I've got a whole backstory for him that I will hopefully bring into bits in later episodes, later seasons about his whole backstory.
Good.
But his father was Italian, raised by a Jewish mother, though. So, hence the name Trillo, which is an Italian-sounding name.
Yes, and you know what would be funny about that is to do a little backstory on Suede, too. It would be funny.
Absolutely.
Jonathan Geffner, everyone, thanks a lot for coming on here. We're gonna keep everybody, just like we do with everybody who comes on here, try to promote whatever they got going and get more activity and word of mouth as we'll do it.
Sounds good.
Okay, and you and I be in touch or what have you. Let me know if you need anything. And we'll be there with you, and then we'll get you back on here. Stay healthy. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, and we don't have to, we'll do it again before another couple of years ago. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, I look forward.
Good night, Mr. Geffner.
Take care.
Good night, Swade. And maybe you can't hear me.
No, I'll relay the message.
Thank you, John. Ciao.
Bye.
Jonathan Geffner, right there. A lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff to do. It's just, it's great. And, I don't want to tell you, you know where to go. Forget about the books. No, don't forget about the books. I know everybody's doing well with the books, and the books are doing very well. Thank you very much. Please keep getting them, buying them, or what have you, at Amazon and the other places. And, check out, they got a bunch of things to check them in. Check out Mary Parr, P-A-R-R, of course. It doesn't cost you anything to subscribe to these entertaining casts. Do they call them a tube cast or something? They can't call them podcasts. I don't know. Let's just take care of it that way. As we can. Wake up. It is night, friends. Until next time. And in between time, CatoloChronicles.blogspot.com. And all the rest. Happy New Year. We'll try to, next week, check the blog and stuff, and we'll see who's on. In the meantime, good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you may be located. And I'll see you around. I'll be here. I'll be there. Now, let's face it, you're not going to see anybody. You're not going to see each other. Some of you I'll see, because I know you anyway. Good night. Good afternoon, whenever you're listening to this. JuiceTalk.com. And, that's it. I don't have a dummy, but if I did, we would have nothing more to say.